Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Phil Dierking, Brian Lynn, and Susan Shand. But first, the Higher Education Report.
Social media has found its way into almost every part of everyday life. It has even affected college and university admissions. Many colleges and universities in the United States are now using social media to share information with applicants, says George DuPont. He is the director of international admissions at the University of Tampa, a private university in Tampa, Florida. DuPont says admissions officials have found the current generation of college applicants to be more responsive to less formal communications. So now, many schools make sure to post things like policy changes or campus news on their social media accounts. Using social media brings the information directly to students instead of making them find it themselves. And DuPont says it is not just how schools communicate that is changing. School officials are also looking at what applicants post. This year, the test preparation company Kaplan released a study on how admissions officials view applicants' social media presence. Almost 400 admissions officials were questioned. About 70% said it was fair for them to consider an applicant's social media messages and pictures when making their decisions.
George DuPont argues that no admissions official would base a decision about an applicant entirely on what the applicant posts online. Instead, they will likely continue to use the same measures they always have: high school performance records, lists of awards and activities outside of school, and letters of support from teachers. Some schools even require that officials avoid considering applicants' social media accounts. However, DuPont says, an applicant making direct threats of violence against someone is one of the few things that would make most schools completely reconsider an acceptance decision. Yet, Christopher Toribio says even applicants' benign social media activity is having more and more of an effect on admissions officials' decisions. Toribio is the Assistant Director of International Admissions at Orange Coast College, a community college in Orange County, California. Admissions officials do not always get a full picture of the kind of person an applicant is from the traditional application materials, Toribio says. Therefore, many officials view social media as a way of learning more about what an applicant is like beyond just their abilities in the classroom.
Toribio points out that many people working in admissions are much older than the applicants they are considering. These officials' relationship with social media is much different, as they have experienced it only at a later stage in their lives. For example, Toribio was completing his undergraduate studies when Facebook was launched in 2004. He remembers when only people with college or university email accounts could join the site. George DuPont at the University of Tampa says when he first started working in admissions, people had only just begun using email. Because they did not grow up with social media, many officials may not have the same understanding as the applicants of what is good and bad behavior online, Toribio argues. And if the officials are considering social media activity, this difference in understanding could make them decide against an applicant. Things on social media can be taken out of context really, really quick, Toribio said. And especially if you're being viewed or judged by individuals that don't know how to use social media the way that you use it, it can definitely be interpreted in different ways. Toribio and DuPont both suggest students could make their accounts private, as schools do not require social media information. But they also admit that freedom of speech is protected in the U.S., and students have every right to post whatever they like online.
However, Toribio says, it is smart for an applicant to be at least a little concerned about how a college or university might view their online activity. So there are a few simple points students can consider before posting anything online. If you're going to be posting a photo of you partying or using drugs or something, or racial slurs, or anything like that, of course, that's going to raise a red flag, Toribio said. Because the thing that we're looking for in a student is somebody that can represent our campus. And those are things that are going to be very alarming to admissions officials. He adds that there are many things applicants can post online that might help their candidacy. Advocating for causes or seeking to share information about major events happening around the world are some good examples. So is presenting art or business projects. Even political debates can reflect well on an applicant, as long as they are balanced and welcoming of opposing ideas. Toribio says no thoughtful admissions officer would decide against an applicant just because they disagree politically. In the end, George DuPont says the main rule for any social media post is that applicants should consider how different kinds of people might react. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now it's time for Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore the meaning and usage of everyday expressions in American English. Today, we will talk about two parts of your head, the tongue and cheek. When you put them together, you get something funny. A tongue-in-cheek comment or observation begins seriously but ends humorously. However, behind the playfulness is truth. So, tongue-in-cheek comments often get people thinking. Tongue-in-cheek comments are often used in critiques. They tell something truthful, but in a lighthearted, funny way. You can sometimes get away with a lot by using tongue-in-cheek humor, because the truth in it can sometimes be hard to recognize. The American writer Mark Twain was an expert at making tongue-in-cheek comments. Another famous humorist was Will Rogers. He was born in 1879 in what is now Oklahoma. He was part Cherokee and was known as the cowboy philosopher. Roger's warm humor made him one of the best love performers of his generation. During his long career, Rogers did a little of everything. He was an actor, both in the theater and in movies. He had a weekly radio show and also wrote stories for a newspaper. This tongue-in-cheek comment from Rogers is as meaningful today as it was when he said it many years ago.
Everything is changing in America. People are taking the comedians seriously and the politicians as a joke.
Now, we all know that no one can know everything, but that fact doesn't sound very interesting, funny, or witty. Will Rogers stated that truth in his typical tongue-in-cheek way when he said,
"Everybody is ignorant, only on different subjects."
But how did putting your tongue in your cheek come to mean a kind of twisted, oftentimes truthful humor? Some websites say this expression dates back to 18th century England. One site says that it first meant a common facial expression used to express dislike or contempt. These days, the contempt is gone, and in its place is irony. An irony is when you say the opposite of what you mean, usually to be funny. Another website says that people may have stuck their tongue in their cheek to prevent them from smiling or laughing. However, when it comes right down to it, you should not take a tongue-in-cheek comment at face value. It starts to mean one thing, but then ends up meaning something completely different. That is what makes it so funny. Tongue-in-cheek humor is often successful when it includes the speaker in a funny critique or situation. In this way, tongue-in-cheek humor can be self-deprecating. It is effective when you want to make fun of yourself a bit. And this brings us to music. For some reason, country and Western music has a long history of producing tongue-in-cheek songs. With titles like She Thinks My Tractor's Sexy, Queen of My Double-Wide Trailer, and Bubba Shot the Jukebox, it is clearly a type of music that does not mind poking fun at its own culture and lifestyle. In the 1970s, Mac Davis became one of the biggest names in country music. He wrote songs for Elvis, and because he was so handsome, also got into acting. Then in 1974, he had everyone laughing with his tongue-in-cheek song, making fun of his own life. "It's Hard to Be Humble" became an instant hit. And that's Words and Their Stories. Out of all the programs here at Voice of America, this is one of them. I'm Ana Mateo.
Imagine storing digital information in deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA, the substance that carries genetic information in the cells of living things. What about wearing a device that makes you more intelligent or creating new materials by changing the genes of microorganisms? These ideas may sound unreal, but scientists are creating technologies that use their knowledge of biology and make changes with a computer. These scientists are working with artificial intelligence, or AI, using the power of computers to copy intelligent human behavior. Some of the researchers presented their findings at the 2018 Milken Institute Global Conference. The meeting was held recently in Los Angeles, California. The researchers spoke at a group discussion called Things That Will Blow Your Mind. The machine finds stuff in biology that a human would never find, said Joshua Hoffman, chief executive officer of Zymergen. He said his company is performing experiments that would never have been possible just a few years ago. Zymergen uses computers to design experiments that change the genetic structure of microorganisms. As a result of the changes, the chemicals produced by microbes can make stronger or better materials. We use automation and machine learning to engineer microbes, to turn them into the chemical factories of the future, Hoffman said. What we're doing is we're searching the genome for the things that might work. What machine learning does is it looks for patterns that a human wouldn't find in ways that are more likely than not to have the genetic changes in the genome that are going to have the impact, the trait that we want. Hoffman said that what takes humans years to discover, computers can do in months. His company works mainly with the chemicals and materials industry, as well as with agricultural companies. He added that Zymergen works on creating non-harmful chemical products that protect plants from disease. Vivian Ming set up Sokos Labs, an independent research group. Ming studies how the brain works. She wants to know if it is possible to make human beings more intelligent by physically putting things into their brain. How much you can think about, pay attention to, mentally operate on at any given moment, we've actually found that we can increase that by about 15%, she said. Laboratories around the world are already studying different ways to improve the brain's cognition and treat conditions like autism and depression. Ming said one example of how this research could help is by improving the cognition of underserved children. Instead of requiring students to attend special classes, Ming said, we might actually be able to use that technology that brings them right back up with the rest of the kids. In a world with artificial intelligence, improving cognition is one way for humans to compete with machines, she added. Hyunjun Park and his company, Catalog, make artificial DNA used to store digital information. Park warned that since people are creating so much information from the internet, social media, and wireless communications, we soon will not have enough space to store it. He feels we need a new way to save this information. Park said current digital forms of information storage take up a lot of land and city space. It also costs lots of money to supervise. However, Park feels that DNA can store much more information and that it can last thousands of years. He says his company has learned how to do it for less money than other laboratories. Park said his company's researchers use a liquid, which they move to look like different pieces of DNA. Then, for storage, they dry it into particles, which are stored in a container. He said an industrial-size model for DNA storage can be ready as early as 2019. Park says that as biology scientists continue to explore the future of artificial intelligence, investors are starting to pay attention. I'm Phil Dierking.
Most people do not look forward to going to the dentist. But they might actually enjoy visiting an American museum that explores the history of teeth and dentistry. The Dr. Samuel D. Harris National Museum of Dentistry is at the University of Maryland in Baltimore. It was the world's first college to train dentists. A man named G.V. Black was one of the founders of modern U.S. dentistry in the 1800s. Visitors to the museum can look at a reproduction of Black's dentist office. When he treated patients, he had no electricity for light, so his office, like many others, had large windows. Chairs for patients often faced south to help dentists work by sunlight. Patrick Cutter is a researcher at the museum.
What we're looking at here is kind of an early idea of what a dentist's office would have looked like, but most of the time a dentist would have actually just been a traveling dentist, so he would have went from town square to town square.
With more than 40,000 items, the museum contains one of the largest dental collections in the world. Visitors can see some of the tools used by early dentists to work on patients. Some of the old equipment looks more like torture devices than dental instruments. Others shown seem fit for kings and queens. For example, Queen Victoria's dentist used instruments made of gold and pearls. The museum shows many examples of false teeth, along with explanations about the kinds of materials used to make them. One of the most popular areas shows a set of false teeth once worn by America's first president, George Washington. But the museum corrects a widely believed story that Washington's false teeth were wooden. They were actually made of animal bone. Historians believe the false teeth made it difficult for Washington to eat and speak. They say this is likely why his second inaugural speech contained just 135 words, the shortest in history. Some early tools used to clean teeth were also made from animal parts, the museum's Patrick Cutter explains.
Some of the older toothbrushes that were actually made out of animal bone.
The cleaning end of the brushes often came from the hair of cows or other animals. The museum also shows teeth from a mix of animals and notes how they are different from human teeth. In addition, visitors can explore how teeth have long been used to solve mysteries and crimes. And they can see the history of tooth replacement and learn about new technology that could grow replacement teeth. One part of the museum, called Mouth Power, contains large toothbrushes and mouths. The models show how bacteria can damage the teeth and let people practice cleaning methods. I'm Brian Lynn.
When Americans Kay and Larry Day found a store selling kites nearly 20 years ago, they decided to buy a few kites for their family. For fun, Larry bought one for himself. He went out and flew it and decided he needed to go back and get a better one, Kay remembered. Since then, she and her husband have loved kite flying. They own many kites and plan trips around flying them. They also organize a kite flying event each winter in their hometown in Iowa. "I'm at peace when I'm flying," said Larry. Kite flying has a long history as an activity for adults and children. The custom of flying a piece of cloth high in the sky began more than 2,000 years ago in China. Since then, kites have been used to do scientific experiments, power boats, take pictures from the air, and much more. "There is a kind of a kite for everybody out there," said Nick O'Neill, president of the American Kite Flyers Association. O'Neill told the Associated Press that kite flying can be done alone or with friends and families. "Kites appeal to people who like to create works of art to fly in the sky, to engineers who try to improve on the kite's design, and to those who like to combine kite flying with music," she explained. "The best thing about it is you can come at it from different points in your life and have it be a completely different experience," she said. Grant Lovett began flying simple kites as a child, but moved on to more costly and complex kites as an adult. Among the latter is a nearly 13-meter-long inflatable kite. Today, Lovett likes making his own kites. He builds them from strong, lightweight materials and products designed for sailboats. "I've always been interested in stuff that flies," he said. Lovett likes taking his creations to public events and sharing them with others. He attends kite-making classes and looks for new models on the internet. "I don't make tons and tons of the same thing," he said. "I like making new kites, finding new designs." Lovett makes kites of different shapes and sizes because flying conditions can differ greatly. "Flying kites requires skill, but also a little artistry," he noted. "Experience makes a difference, as does the weather. Part of the reason I like kiting is that you have to risk trying and not succeeding. The best way to learn is to go out, undo the string, and let your kite fly," O'Neill said. "Ideally, you want a nice, steady wind and a place away from trees and buildings," O'Neill said. "Sometimes the best flying conditions happen in winter on a frozen lake," said Kay Day, who, with her husband, organizes the Color the Wind Kite Festival. It takes place every February on Clear Lake in Iowa. The festival adds color to the winter sky and gives people a reason to go outside, she added. The days invite expert flyers to come share their love for kites with locals and visitors. This year, more than 100 children attended a kite-making class. I'm Susan Shand.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.